Hello. In this episode of AS for Architecture, I speak with Monica Montserrat Deegan, Professor in Urban Cultural Sociology at Brunel University, and Gillian Rose, Professor of Human Geography at the University of Oxford, about their 2022 book, The New Urban Aesthetic, Digital Experiences of Urban Change, published by Bloomsbury.
AS for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture and space.
Hello and welcome to another episode of AS for Architecture. I'm talking today to Gillian Rose and Monica Deegan. Is that Deegan or Deegan?
No, Deegan, officially. Thank you.
Monica Montserrat Deegan, by the way. We're talking today about their recent book, The New Urban Aesthetic, Digital Experiences of Urban Change, which has been published by Bloomsbury, I think, in 2022. But before we get on with talking about the book, perhaps you'll be able to introduce yourself. Gillian first.
Hello, hi, I'm Gillian Rose. I'm Professor of Human Geography at the University of Oxford. And I'm interested in visual culture, cities and digital technologies at the moment. And learnt huge amounts from collaborating with Monica.
Well, that was nice and very short. So how do you find yourself? What is an academic in human geography? What do they do? I mean, lots of things. What isn't human geography?
Well, that is a very appropriate rhetorical question. Yeah, I mean, one of the things I enjoy about geography is that it's the interdisciplinary discipline. If any geographers will listen will know that there's quite a divide within a discipline between people who look at kind of hardcore physical sciences, environmental sciences, and human geographers, who tend to be a pretty eclectic mix of people interested in places, landscapes, cities, nations, all these kind of spatial categories that we look at from a whole series of different perspectives, sociological, political, economic, cultural, technological. So it's a fabulous discipline for trying to bring things together that are often not thought of in relation to each other. And I just to start the plugging of the book, which is just now available in paperback, I believe. That was one of the things we were trying to do in the book, I guess, bring together things that haven't necessarily been thought together, particularly digital technologies and urban redevelopment.
That's really good. And a good plug, too. Monica.
Hello.
You're also a professor, but not in human geography.
No, I'm actually a professor in urban cultural sociology at Brunel University, London. And yeah, I'm very much interested in the sensory and experiential aspects of urban redevelopment and urban change. So I'm really fascinated by how places are not just constructed through bricks, but also through feelings, through experiences we have in them, through what we do in places. And all of that creates a sense of place. And I'm really interested in how that sense of place gets enhanced, disrupted, mediated through urban redevelopment. And yeah, I guess overall, I would describe myself as having a heavy interest in people and how people interact in the city, and how, as Richard Sennett says, flesh and stone, construct the city together.
Beautiful. So that's a really interesting human-centered book. And what attracted me to the book, I saw it pop up, I think, on Twitter. Through either one of your own personal accounts or through the Bloomsbury account, was this fact that it's coming out in paperback. But I have a PhD student at the moment who is looking at something that's adjacent to this, which is the kind of the way that cities are starting to be both imagined and produced through digital platforms, through the digital. And this emergence of an idea of the city as a digital space. And it's very complicated because this is not specifically within my field of expertise. So I thought it would be an amazing opportunity to get people who quite clearly are expert in this to talk about that. So perhaps we could start with an introduction about what the book is trying to address. I know, Gillian, you've already talked about it, and Monica too, a little bit. but perhaps a kind of like, what was its motivation? Where does it come from? And I suppose, where does it point towards?
Okay, I'll make a start on that. So we very much started writing the book with the conviction that, you know, over the last 10, 15 years, a big change and a big transformation has happened to how we experience cities. And over, you know, as usual with academics, over a cup of coffee, we talked about the different projects that we've done together. We've been working together since 2009, I think. So we were talking then about, you know, projects we'd done together, but also with other teams. And for example, one of the first projects we did together looked very much at, it looked at the role of computer-generated images in architecture practices and urban representations. So this change we noticed was that you know, the digital was really coming through in our research. Increasingly, also when we interviewed people, like I did a project on the transformation of Smithfield Market in 2017-18, and what I noticed then is that when I asked people about you know, what Smithfield Market meant to them or why they were there, they often either had already a phone in their hands, or they took out their phone to illustrate why they were there, how they got there, the restaurants they were going to visit, etc. So what then really came clear through, you know, these, and Gillian will talk in a minute a bit more about a project she did on smart cities. So what was coming clearer and clearer, becoming clearer and clearer to us, is that how people perceive and live the city is increasingly mediated by all different types of digital technologies. And, you know, anybody can probably relate to this. When you're lost in the city, immediately you bring out your smartphone. Or not even when you're lost, when you're at home and you're trying to think how you're getting somewhere, first thing we do, we look it up on Google Maps, for example. Or new urban developments are increasingly mainly conceived and designed and marketed with computer generated images that are then advertised across social media. But also city users use social media to know where the hippest bar is or the latest museum show they want to visit. And actually, younger people have also told me that TikTok now is used very much to plan their holidays and their weekends away, or their weekends in the city. So that really came very clear to us when we sat together in 2018 to think about what we wanted to write about. And it became increasingly clear that the aim of the book needs to be about, you know, how does it feel like to inhabit digitally mediated urban spaces?
Yeah, this word mediation is doing a lot of heavy lifting, and I think it's a word I chuck around as well. And I think perhaps people who have a background in sociology do use it quite easily, and perhaps it's a word that we can come back to kind of better understand, because it sounds simple, but it isn't simple, is it? But Gillian, I mean, what where do you? I mean, I suppose it would be really interesting to, as a geographer of city space, amongst other things, to kind of track this trajectory towards this moment that I think we're all very conscious of. This, I mean, I can even remember it in the years before the smartphone came out, when I was living in London, the feeling of being like made extremely vulnerable by forgetting your old block phone. You know, remember when you had text messages by like pressing the buttons millions of times. But even when you were going out to meet friends and you'd forgotten that phone, it was almost as bad as forgetting your wallet, because all of a sudden, the way that one negotiated a city was starting to be facilitated, enabled by very simple digital technology at the time. But so has there been a general flow? Is this something that is specific to a certain location? Is this a sort of what global north kind of situation? And where has it come from?
Yeah, no, those are great questions. So you're absolutely right that there's a long history to the kind of obviously to the moment we're in now. And it's not a history that's been driven entirely by simply by technological innovation. You know, Apple, the smartphone clearly changed an awful lot of things. But there's a great paper by the geographer Matthew Wilson that actually looks at the palm connected mobile device, which I think was maybe even a precursor to those kind of blocky phones that you were talking about, which I can't remember the date, must have been probably being sold in kind of late 80s, maybe early 90s. And what he emphasizes is just how much work, like through adverts, through kind of events and promos and demos, had to be done to persuade people that we did actually need to carry these things around with us, and to be anxious when we left them behind, and to feel that we had to be connected, and we had to be connected all the time through these devices that have become increasingly, you know, small, increasingly networked, increasingly connected, you know, longer and longer battery life, greater and greater range, and so on and so forth. So there are these long histories. And as I say, it's not just a question of technical innovation. So we all get carried along by that. There's a lot of work done to persuade us that we need to feel these kinds of ways. I think that points to the importance of the kind of commercial imperative behind a lot of these things. And certainly now, the emergence of platforms has really, in terms of the kind of social media experience, that's really shifted things. But I think alongside that in cities, and perhaps that's, you know, it's not something our book focuses on, so perhaps it's not something we want to pay a lot of attention to in our conversation now. But there's also been a lot of movement towards trying to use digital data of different kinds, not least that generated by smartphones, in order to manage cities better through the idea of a smart city or a city digital twin, you know, gathering data about a city in order to improve is the claim, its management. So there's a lot of digitally enabled, shall we say, I'll avoid the word mediation, but digitally enabled change going on in both the management and the everyday experiencing of cities. And I think what Monica and I really wanted to pick up on the book, because there's quite a lot of work now thinking about platform urbanism, smart city management and so on. What we really wanted to focus on was this kind of everyday embodied experience, which is about smartphones, but it's also about smartwatches, for example. You know, there's actually quite a lot of devices that we interact with. We when we're walking around a city, we probably pass and register on various kinds of sensors embedded in the environment that we're not aware of. You know, driving around, automated car number plate recognition, facial recognition software through CCTV cameras. You know, there's actually quite a lot of ways in which our embodied experience of urban life is now pulled through and made sense of various digital devices.
So commerce is at the heart of it, but there is also a sense of the transformation of the post-industrial city from a space of labor, of working class industrial labor, to leisure. And the mobile, the smart device relates much more closely to that. It's sort of the city as a playground, and we need to interact with our, and as a space of consumerism, and we need to interact with our mobile phones to enable that, than it is, or whatever device it is, than it is to do with. So it's a kind of, it sits alongside this utter transformation of many cities, not even global north cities anymore. Many cities are doing this, aren't they?
Definitely. But I also think there isn't a clear divide between the industrial and the post-industrial city. I mean, I don't know, maybe it's my own ignorance, but I was very surprised when I got to Seattle or other cities, how industrial a lot of cities still are. And industry plays a huge role, even in London, but cities that I know better, yeah, London, Barcelona, etc. It's just moved to the outskirts, or it's moved from the global north, as we know, to the global south. And it's there. So I think, you know, the cities are like, there isn't a clear divide. We, you know, yeah, I'll leave it with that. But I think what is very interesting is this, you know, gradual decline of industry or move towards city centres, focusing on the service industry and culture in a broad term. And in my view, it is partly because, you know, as globalization has enabled people to travel more, but also has enabled the travel of urban discourses and urban planning forms, etc. Cities are becoming a little bit more alike than before. I mean, there's always been, you know, a traveling of architectural fashions, of course, but it's been more accentuated, I guess, more through the media, tourism, like I said, and other trends that I can't really go into all of them now at the moment. But I think that's why cities, you know, since the 1980s have started to focus more and more on their experiences, the late 1980s. And that's also when this trend of urban regeneration has really taken off, starting in Baltimore, as we know, by the work of David Harvey, etc., and has then traveled across the globe as one economy that is now you know, fostering investment in cities by then attracting tourists, financial investment, developers, etc., etc. And what I think, I mean, what I've always, since my PhD, actually, I've been very interested in is that there is a trend in Anglo-Saxon academia of having these, you know, mega terms like the postmodern city or postmodernism. And actually, when you start looking even within Europe at how these trends express themselves locally, it's very different. And it all depends on you know, the local politics, economy, culture, and then post, you know, these trends get rearticulated very differently in different cities, even within different neighborhoods. And I guess we've been very interested in the book to understand how something that we describe as the new urban aesthetic expresses itself very differently in very different locations, within very different urban development context, within different policy and cultural context. Yeah, so I don't know if I'm answering your questions.
No, for certain. And yeah. I think that's a really interesting idea, and perhaps one I hadn't picked up on reading the book, which is this idea that, and we'll come to this right now, but this idea of the new the way that you're interrogating these spaces and these processes is in some part to do with kind of challenging these monolithic ideas, these monolithic concepts which are used to characterize giant areas and giant number, you know, populations. But perhaps it would be most useful and apposite to talk about this idea of the new urban aesthetic. After all, it is the title of the book. What is it, and how have you kind of gone about, I suppose, exploring it? Because it's a kind of case study driven book, isn't it? And it would be quite nice to understand, like, how these examples kind of illustrate that.
Yeah, I'll have a go at that.
Go on, Gillian.
I mean, I guess one thing to say is that the materials in the case studies are really critical to the book, because we want to embed the idea of difference, different places mattering, you know, at the real kind of heart of the arguments. But they were case studies that were conducted before we kind of thought about putting them together in a kind of book form. So the framework kind of fell out from the case studies. But if I can go back to the phrase, the new urban aesthetic, and kind of unpack that a bit. So the urban, we've already talked quite a bit about that, and it's specifically about the prevalence a lot of private capital pouring into cities in this sort of differentiated but perhaps post-industrial moment, cities having to turn increasingly to external forms of investment to regenerate areas. So that's the particular kind of angle of the urban. The new is perhaps a little bit of a misnomer, because again, we've said long histories, but the new refers to this increased digital mediation of what cities look like, what they feel like, what they sound like. Somebody was showing me a whole series of Wes Anderson style TikTok videos filmed in Barcelona. And she found them on TikTok through the soundtrack, through the kind of cutesy music. So there's a whole lot of, which is the aesthetic. So in terms of the aesthetic, we're using quite a particular definition, which I think is the kind of original definition of the word, if you like, which is a sensory experience. So that takes us back to this notion of embodied, everyday kind of material experiences, what we feel like, both sort of corporeally, but perhaps also emotionally, you know, as we encounter the city in particular circumstances, very often holding, you know, that smart screen in our hands, or maybe seeing large display screens around an environment, or encountering digital technologies in other ways. So that's the new urban aesthetic, this sense that, that there's a new form of embodied experiencing of the urban, which many of us are being encouraged to occupy and sense when we're in urban places. And just to say a little bit more for folk interested, we draw specifically on the work of Henri Lefebvre, a very eminent Marxist urban sociologist, who has quite a nuanced vocabulary around thinking about the different modes of understanding space. He has three notions of space: conceived, perceived, lived. And if you kind of put those together, different versions of those, you get these kind of different senses of what's been called the kind of textures of urban space. And we elaborate that theoretically, but then the case studies we suggest all exemplify specific textures of the new urban aesthetic in different places with slightly different effects on the kind of embodied experiencing of those places.
Fantastic. I was struck by this when I was reading the beginning of the book, and I would love you, Monica, to talk a little bit perhaps about some of these differences that you note in these different spaces. And whether this framework of analysis that you've developed is applicable more broadly outside the cities that you put it. And obviously, because you're good scholars, I'm sure it is. But this idea of moving away from what you call a Kantian idea of aesthetics, a kind of disembodied and disinterested aesthetics, towards, as you called it, did you call it, Gillian, a correct idea or original idea of aesthetics, a kind of classical idea of bodiliness, which is very much associated with Lefebvrean ideas around what he called the sensory sensual, which I think is really fascinating. So before we go there and perhaps try and understand a little bit how this digital experiencing enables this bodily thing, because that seems really counterintuitive to me. It seems like perhaps the digital platforms are a way of further alienating people from everyday realities, but you're arguing the opposite. But perhaps we could get to these case studies first that you've chosen and think and hear a little bit about these different textures that you're noting.
Before we do that, I actually want to talk about something that just came, but talking now in this podcast to you is, you know, becoming clearer and clearer to me. It says basically, you were talking about, you know, features of the postmodern city and our work. And I guess one of our key starting points was to really think about what Pine and Gilmore already in 1999 described as the experience economy. But we've actually drawn on the German philosopher Böhme to call it aesthetic economy. They're very similar concepts. Basically, the entrepreneur, what's happening with the entrepreneurial processes that are quite different, but you know they are happening across the globe, is that cities and have to compete ever more fiercely on what I've described as our global catwalk for attention, and this attention is the feel, the atmosphere of the city, the experience of the city. So you know, is, you know, when areas get redeveloped, the first step is always to you know, transform often the atmosphere that's there or enhance it, depending, you know, what kind of redevelopment you're talking about. But it's very much about changing the sensory character of an area. And, you know, they get classically, they get traditionally, they get cleaned up, for example, or certain things get enhanced, certain historical heritage features get enhanced, others get wiped away to oblivion. Then we have also cultural practices like the famous, you know, pop-up art or farmer markets, etc. And all of that really shows how the sensorial and the branding and of cities and the entrepreneurial processes are all linked up increasingly together. And the link between all of these processes, I guess partly we're arguing, is that the digital has become so central in these branding processes of cities. So you know, from tourist selfies and or also from residents images in Facebook, on Instagram, on TikTok, increasingly the feel, the atmosphere, the sensoriality of cities is what is being captured, and that's what also then attracts investment over time. Yeah, so and that's all done and mediated and captured and reframed and shared by using digital devices. And that's what we wanted to really illustrate through the three case studies. So in the three case studies, we have three very different developments. And I'll look at Gillian also for help with this. So we started by looking at development that we studied together with Claire Melouish at UCL, which is a development in Qatar. And there we identified basically aesthetics of glamour. And what we looked at there was actually the digitally, no, I'm now sorry, it's early in the morning, the computer generated images. Now I've got it. Sorry. Yeah, we looked at CGIs and that were used to both develop the project, but also then to brand it. And we focused very much on the development of the project. It was led and very much pushed through these computer generated images. And what we saw there, if you analyze those images, is that they were very much digitally, of course, manipulated, but to allure audiences, investors, etc., to really you know, through lighting device, through specific lighting devices and textures of the urban, to want to invest both in terms of living there, but also of buying these spaces. And we called it glamour by drawing on work by Virginia Postrel, whose book we really enjoyed, because glamour is about making ordinary objects, you know, appear almost magical and elegant, etc. But also what she says is that picturing glamour must, and I'm quoting here, must generate enough familiarity to engage the imagination, but must remain a little vague. So it was really trying to suggest, you know, what it would feel like to inhabit these spaces. I don't know if Gillian wants to add a bit to that.
Yeah, I maybe I could, but also then lead on to one of the other case studies. So so I think these CGIs will be familiar to many people listening to this, you know, either having seen them in city streets and billboards around building sites, or indeed possibly creating them. And I guess they are quite easy to critique in the terms that Monica's just suggested. You know, they're glamorized, they offer very positive visions of these big, you know, big, very often very sort of intrusive new urban development projects. But I think we wanted to also suggests that maybe there's a more kind of pervasive effect that they're having, especially when they're accompanied by lots of other interactions with different kinds of digitalized experiences of urban life. And one of the other aesthetics that we identified was what we call drama. Dramatic experiences of urban life, and that's very much when people, often in places that are hyped and marketed in the same kind of ways, you know, using similar kind of CGI imagery to the glamorous ones, but that social media starts to be used for people to make their own images of what goes on in those places, and often partly because it's all about selling experiences and the experiential in the city, there'll be kind of cultural events. That the particular case study is the Smithfield Market regeneration project in London. So what you find there is both the promoters of this regeneration project producing their own lovely CGIs, or indeed their own social media feeds about all the amazing things going on in this place, but also a lot of ordinary social media users posting their own images, and often very highly crafted, you know, Instagram images, that aesthetic of Instagram, where and in both cases what you're getting is a real emphasis on the kind of dramatic, the event, the out of the ordinary, you know, something that's kind of extraordinary that you want to share, and we called that particular kind of aesthetic dramatic. And it kind of relates to the glamour, but it's a kind of inflection of it. And then we have a third case study which looked at a whole series of smartphone apps that were developed in the UK city of Milton Keynes when it was trying presenting itself to potential investors as a smart city, as a place where digital technologies can be trialed in an urban environment. So a lot of experimental apps, all of which assumed that what you would most want to do in a city is move around it in the most efficient way possible. Whether those were transport apps, whether they were apps showing you where different kind of facilities were in urban spaces, even apps that showed you where different heritage sites were. It was all about getting you moving. This assumption that if you're in a city, what you're wanting to be doing is be mobile. So that was a very kind of kinetic aesthetic, I suppose, the bodily aesthetic of flow, of movement, of mobility, which the others kind of have to an extent. But again, this was quite distinctive, and we associated it particularly with this kind of smart city development in Milton Keynes. And I think the point of all these case studies is that they are distinct to the particular case studies, but I'm sure elements of them will be found elsewhere because similar processes are going on elsewhere. You know, Google Maps makes us all mobile, whatever city we're in, that's the point of it. But the vocabulary that we were developing on with the idea of textures suggests that also other places might be generating different kinds of textured new urban aesthetics, other than the three that we amplify in the book.
Fantastic. So I'm really interesting. We've used the word mediated, and you've used the word the everyday, postmodern kind of concept of the everyday, which I think are both quite interesting. But and listening to you talk, there's this kind of scale of what you're talking about is counter the grand plan, the master plan. It's about how, if I'm right, and correct me if I'm wrong, about how there's a sort of co-production of urban identity, which is self-coordinating or sort of a bit coordinated and also a bit granular, or are digital platforms, because are digital platforms involved in this process? Because I suppose the question for me is like, what is the impact of this on the physical environment? Is there a feedback loop from this kind of granular data gathering of people's interpretations and manipulations of impressions and the generation of this new urban aesthetic? Does this then become a device used for actual urban regeneration? Are people now then going, well, we're going to build a place that's Instagrammable. We're going to build a community that has, I assume they do. Is there evidence to suggest that this is happening?
Yes, you just need to walk down Oxford Street or actually King's Road, I think, also in London. I mean, one thing that's increasingly popping up are little Instagrammable moments, either next to shops with the pink flowers. It's a typical, an arch, it's usually an arch. With flowers or some other birds or other cute things, are displayed, and you see pictures, you know, people taking in Instagram pictures there, etc. But what I've noticed in my research as well, especially in London, is that developers and planners are very aware of the Instagrammable moments, and public art or events are actually planned with social media in mind. Not only, there are other reasons, of course, I'm not saying that's the only reason, but it's definitely a big factor in the, both in branding the event before it happens, but also in having these pop-up events, pop-up art, pop-up everything stalls that will then circulate very rapidly, you know, through some key influencers. They might even be invited, but they don't even, you know, they don't need to be invited, but some key people. And I'm talking of small influencers, like a mother that might be quite popular or something on Instagram or have a lot of followers. And they then circulate the event, and you know, it's part of the branding process that definitely cities but also cultural institutions are very aware of and use. I mean, every department and every institution, including our universities, have a social media branding policy, but also departments are associated with them. What I find really interesting, and I guess in the book we haven't had time to develop it in detail, but there are also all kind of problems emerging through that. And I'm just aware of something that is happening at the moment in Barcelona, for example, in El Carmel, a neighborhood in Barcelona, which had the most Instagram image of Barcelona near some Civil War bunkers, where people tend to congregate to take a picture of the whole city because they're higher up on a mountain, and where I used to go as a teenager, but nobody was there. Now there are thousands of people congregating to see the sunset over Barcelona. However, there were so many that the neighbors, etc., couldn't sleep, and there was a lot of tension between locals and visitors coming to be there. So now the city has closed the area off from 5 p.m. onwards in the last 2 months. And they're trying to think how to negotiate, you know, all of this. And I mean, there's very interesting work also by Paiva and Sanchez Fueros on Lisbon, where they look at collateral atmospheres and the tensions between tourists and locals in the city of Lisbon, for example, as well. And I think there's more and more of that emerging. And it'd be interesting to see how city governments actually deal with these issues.
I mean, my assumption has been for a while that Google Maps, for example, is produced, that local authorities pay Google Maps to preference certain routes, to drive up rates and to mediate traffic. So just as you can use big data to kind of route people to alleviate traffic congestion at rush hour, you could also divert people on foot traffic down a road to increase its tourist qualities and drive up rates. So I'm assuming that there is, if I've thought of it, and I'm not that smart, I'm sure someone in local government or government has thought of it and has been, and I'm sure someone in Google has been writing that that invitation to local authorities. So I'm assuming that is what is already happening.
If I could jump in there, Amber, I don't think that's happening, partly because I don't think any local authority could afford to pay Google what Google would want to change its algorithm. But you are right, though, that Google Maps is more complicated than it looks. So the geographer Mark Graham has done some work looking at the different search results you get if you search on Google Maps using different languages. And his particular example actually is looking at the West Bank. And there you can see very clearly, when you search in Arabic and when you search in Hebrew, you get very, very different place names, different places appear or disappear. So it's not as direct, I think, as Google being paid. But whatever the information, and who knows, it's a tightly guarded commercial secret, right? Whatever the dynamics that Google are using to populate Google Maps, it's certainly not some kind of mirror representation of the real world. Mm. But I think that's one of the issues one of the ways of approaching the digital that we wanted perhaps to kind of inflect a little bit with our emphasis on kind of embodiment and so on. Because I don't think it's entirely just a question of whether the digital represents the real accurately or not. The real is being shaped in relation to particular versions, particular aesthetics. And this is impacting people differently. So just to add on another example to the ones that Monica just raised, there's a study working with a very large data set of images made in Amsterdam to be posted on Instagram, a book coming out this year by Boy and Utermark, which I highly recommend. One of the examples they use there is a very kind of local urban consultant who's particularly interested in resisting the gentrification of Amsterdam neighborhoods, which is very visible on Instagram. You can see as the cafes move in and the cute houses, they appear on Instagram as a kind of driver and the sign of gentrification. This particular consultant though is really keen to avoid pushing out of places that don't look Instagrammable, which are very often the kind of poorer places. They're often perhaps local businesses that ethnic minority entrepreneurs have established, your kind of classic 24-hour corner shop. And she offers a service to those business owners, immigrant business owners, to convert their business to something that will look good on Instagram. So they could be selling the same stuff, but she's just explaining to them how they can display things, how they can, take a photograph of them, how they can share it with the right influencer to get that business reshaped into a kind of ethnicized, diverse experience, which actually speaks to the kind of coolness of the gentrifying neighborhood, rather than something it has to be pushed out because it looks dirty or messy or, that doesn't correspond to what gentrification should look like in Instagram. So I think there are real, that this emphasis on sort of thinking about bodies is kind of very granular. But bodies themselves are not individual. They're caught up in questions of race, class, gender, belonging, not belonging, immigrants, outside, all sorts of different social dynamics are played out through embodied experiences. And that's also what we wanted to try and flag, at least in the book. I think we agree now we both could have done a bit more of that in the book. But it's certainly something that we continue to think hard about in relation to these issues.
That's fantastic. And that kind of does address, in the notes I wrote to you, this issue around the way that this mediation, to come back to this word, produces certain desired or undesired effects, particularly around the generation of thresholds which create barriers for inclusion or exclusion, which is kind of a fascinating and a whole other world of discourse and another challenge. I suppose as a final and very quick thing, because I, as you know, have other things bearing down on me with horrible speed, but I just wanted to know a little bit about how you see, perhaps for an architecture student, what this might, and you probably haven't turned your mind to this, what this might mean in terms of how we start talking about cities to students and to learners. Like, what What does this point towards? If we're thinking about education as a process of preparation for the future, what does this point towards? Where are we going? Where are these? What is the trajectory here?
I mean, I do teach my students. I used the book last year and the years before, yeah, when I was writing it to teach from it. And they love listening or thinking about social media as they're so involved in it. Young people and older ones as well. I think what's for me really important is, first of all, to really make the point that whether it's TikTok or Instagram, these are huge corporations. And they're a cultural part maybe of the creative industries, but they have a much stronger, you know, financial kind of incentive than a theater production or anything mm-hmm. else. So to really think about, you know, the power that these global corporations have in framing the choice of filters, the choice of how we edit pictures, etc. On the one hand, it's democratized, you know, photography, of course, but on the other hand, you know, there's also a limited resource, I would say, of how you can use it, etc. That creates this kind of, for me at least, and Jillian might correct me, but more of a global aesthetic of how things eventually look on Instagram. When you get there, of course, then the whole sensory kicks in and you might feel displaced because the cute flower parade or whatever might be next to really ugly bins or smelly, you know, smelly bins, etc. So that's also quite interesting how, you know, that tension emerges sensorially. So I think it's really important to teach them about that or make them think. And just in general, I think it's really important to also, like my mission, I guess, has been to really think about embodiment as you teach. And to use their own bodies as part of, you know, the knowledge that they create critically of cities, whether they're feeling in place, out of place, what they record, what they don't record, for what reason, and then to think how experience frames, you know, how we interact, therefore, with the city, but also how we are being framed and interacted with in cities. And again, coming back to Barcelona, there's a very interesting book by somebody called Balibrea, looking at how Barcelona, one could argue, has used its citizens itself and the visitors to create atmospheres, and they become almost like protagonists of a film. You know, the public becomes part of what is being sold in the city. That's the lifestyle. And I find that quite an interesting process of commercializing the city as a whole, not just in terms of its heritage or history or buildings.
Yeah.
If I say something, and perhaps more, so completely agree with Monica, given that broader context, something for architecture students, perhaps in particular, speaking as a non-architect. So, but I think... you know, architecture as a discipline, as a itself a profession, is really deeply invested in lots of these issues, because architects also have to sell their projects, right? They have to make a living. You know, they're involved in an awful lot of, you know, these kind of urban redevelopment projects, of course, that we've been talking about, smaller, larger scale. And as part of that, they also have to generate either themselves or by using, you know, visualization studios, you know, the images that are going to sell this project to whoever's going to build it, right? But I think architects also have a skill set to make those images, or at least to think, reflect on their production. And one of the things I'm really intrigued by is what, you know, what kind of images would make it evident to someone who's looking at them, like your ordinary person, or perhaps your community member who's part of a, you know, consultation process or whatever, that these images are not photographs. They're not glamorized photographs, which so many of them, you know, they head for photorealism. They're built on the CAD models. In some ways, they are actually realistic. They might be glamorized through Unreal Engine's ray tracing or whatever, but, you know, they're all 3ds Max's glow, but they're real. But what visually could prompt someone who thinks this looks great. It's like my computer game. It's like the movie I saw. It's going to be into making them think that this is a constructed image, that it was made by someone using particular software, that it's a particular perspective, that it's a particular, you know, it's that lovely, gorgeous glow of dusk, you know, or what is it going to look like in 10 years' time when it's all looking a bit tatty and graffiti, you know, what if there's data being included in the image, you know, where's that data coming from? Can we contextualize it more? You know, what? So I think there's, I wouldn't say that this is going to solve the issue, but a small contribution might be to think of ways of visualizing new urban developments, which make them look more provisional, more open and more engageable with, that we can have conversations around, rather than just sort of saying, oh, that looks lovely, you know, I'd like that, damn it, you know, but actually, you know, is this the kind of urban life we want to be living in these spaces, rather than what do they look like, you know, how glamorous do they feel?
How glamorous. Thank you. That's a wonderful point to finish on. Thank you very much, Gillian. Thank you very much, Monica. It's been a pleasure to skate across the surface of your wonderful book.
Thank you, Ambrose. Thank you very much for listening, everybody, as well.
Thank you.
High drama indeed. Thanks to Gillian and Monica for spending time with me on this, and to Bloomsbury for the book. Links to it and to Gillian and Monica's online presence are in the podcast description, as before. Thanks for listening.